I do miss having a lot of the creative control that I had as an independent author because when it was just me, I could make all the decisions. I designed my own covers. I named my book what I wanted to name it. I wrote back cover copy. I reached out for blurbs. Everything, like the book packaging, was exactly how I envisioned it, how I wanted it to be. And this time around, I had no control over any of that. And that was a really big pill for me to swallow. It was probably the most difficult thing that I encountered with this experience of being with a publisher. And so it did force me to really step back and sort of talk to myself internally, just saying, like, listen, it's okay to not have control over everything. And it's okay to put your trust in these people. They know what they're doing.
Hey there, welcome back to Lit Match, a podcast made to help writers learn how to blend passion with business by learning how to master the writing craft, understand the publishing industry, and find the best literary agent for their business and writing career. I'm Abigail Perry, the host of Lit Match, and a certified developmental editor and book coach eager to support writers on their writing and publishing journey. Today, I have an incredible episode for you with a returning guest, the wonderful author, Jen Craven. If you've turned into Lit Match for a while, you might remember Jen's previous episode, which focused on her self-publishing experience. Jen Craven is the author of Domestic Suspense, which she believes is very much about identity, how much we know about ourselves, and the closest to us. Jen's books feature emotionally charged page-turning plots and characters faced with impossible choices and filled with secrets. She writes from Northwestern Pennsylvania, where she lives with her family. In this episode, Jen shares her decision to shift from self-publishing to traditional publishing, which she did for her last two books, The Baby Left Behind, released in September 2023, and Her Daughter, which released this month, March 2024. I want to point out quickly that I did record this episode prior to each book's release, and I had hoped to release it sooner, but was unable to do so due to personal circumstances. That said, while we do explore questions about each of Jen's most recent books, they are both available for you to read, and I enthusiastically include the links to both of her books in the show notes, so make sure to check those out. Despite my delay in releasing this episode, I cannot recommend Jen's advice to authors enough. She's honest, intelligent, and open-minded, all characteristics that contribute to this episode's awesome conversation that I think can really help writers decide which publishing path is best for them, self-publishing or traditional publishing. With that said, I am thrilled to bring back Jen Craven, and here she is now. Hi, Jen. Thanks for joining me again. I am so excited that you are here to talk about your new book. And also, you are a returning guest, and this is thrilling because you were an amazing guest last time, and we talked about the difference between self-publishing and traditional publishing. Thank you again for being here with me today. I know everyone loved you last time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be back. I'm honored to be asked back, and yeah, totally kind of different stuff to talk about this time, but it all really kind of goes together into, you know, what a writer's publishing journey looks like, and it's ever-changing, so I'm excited to hit on those things today.
Absolutely. And I think that your ability to adapt and make decisions as things are ever changing has always been something that I've admired about you. So let's get into that. Just in case any listeners are unfamiliar with who you are, I know that you've been on the podcast before and we talked about your previous book, but I would like them to get an idea of your writing career and your writing path and just share anything you'd like about your writing credentials.
Sure. So before I was writing full time, I worked in academia. And while I was teaching higher ed, I did a lot of freelance essay writing. So personal essays to a lot of motherhood, parenting outlets, Scary Mommy, Today's Parents, you know, those types of places, because that was like the life that I was living with newborns and toddlers and little kids. And so that really kind of got my writing juices flowing in that way. And it wasn't until about 2019 where I kind of got the idea, I wonder if I could write a book. I mean, I've always been an avid reader. wasn't something that I dreamed of as a child, like to be an author. It kind of sprung up very organically, you know, in my 30s. I wrote my first two books and self-published them. They were historical fiction. And then when I got the idea for my third, it was more of a contemporary story. This would have been my last release, Best Years of Your Life, which came out August 2022. And again, I wasn't sure exactly which route I wanted to take. I did spend some time querying and ended up pulling back all of those queries when my gut was telling me that it wasn't the right choice. And so I know we spent a lot of time on the last podcast talking about that decision and, you know, what went into it and the, you know, the pros and cons and all of that. But long story short, that I did end up self-publishing, indie publishing that title again. So I had three self-published books. And then, you know, that led me to where I am now. And I know one of your follow-up questions is going to be about the current book. So I won't jump to that, but that's a little bit of my backstory. So I'm on, you know, book four is coming out tomorrow and then already working on number five.
Yes. And this is very exciting. So just, I know we're recording this today on September 19th and The Baby Left Behind is her new book. And that comes out September 20th. Let's talk about that story. I particularly am excited about this one. This one is motherhood stories. So yes. When everything deals with motherhood stories, I really, really am drawn to these mother stories. It's been said that it's perfect for fans of Jodi Picco, JoJo Moyes, and Kate Hewitt. Let's hear a little bit about what this story is about, as well as your inspiration for writing it.
So I love motherhood stories. Like you said, they're my all-time favorites. And it could be anything from the really like emotional hearts pulling on your heartstrings to the suspense. But above all, I love stories that are a little bit messy and ones that kind of touch on the rawness and the vulnerable side of motherhood and being a mom and parenting. You know, one of my favorites who I love is Ashley Audrain. And she wrote The Push and The Whispers, which I just absolutely adored. And I know some readers found them a little bit too dark for them and they were tough to get through, but I don't know. I love those. And so I try to kind of weave in some of that suspense and the really ethical questions that you find yourself in as a mom. And so this particular story came to me because I was pairing the whole experience of motherhood with also the experience of infertility. And I've never personally experienced infertility. I'm very fortunate not to have to experience that myself, but I have friends and family who have. And so I just wanted to kind of take a unique spin on that and wrote this character of a woman who suffers from infertility, but for a very specific reason, a medical condition sort of reason, and out of her control. But above all, she wants is to be a mom. And so the longing that goes into that and just all of those emotions. And then, boom, there's a baby who shows up on her doorstep with a note, please keep him. And then it's that split second. What do I do? I know I should call the cops, but here's this baby. And, you know, should I keep him? Should I turn him into the authorities? And, you know, and then all of the fallout that happens from her choices. So I don't want to give too much away, but that's sort of like the premise and the hook. And it ties into a lot of, you know, suspense that's going forward with the story, but also a lot of emotion. And so I think that's kind of the balance.
You pull out a lot of interesting details about how you haven't personally experienced infertility. And also there's this great what if. What would you do if this baby was left at your doorstep? You've been longing for a child. And that's something that I think that we, even if you haven't had the experience of infertility yourself, can put yourself in that position. Everyone seems to have at some point in their life be probably placed in a state of anxiety when you are forced to make a big decision quickly and how that's going to impact a domino effect of consequences, positive or negative. So exactly. This high stakes situation absolutely doesn't the story. And I, when you pitched that last time on the podcast, when we were doing your previous interview, that absolutely was what grabbed my attention. I am interested for writers out there because I think they say write what you know, but we can't always write what we know as well. So how do you go about making sure that even if you haven't experienced something like infertility yourself, mm-hmm. that you're creating authenticity for the character in their situation? How do you get yourself into that emotional state for your characters?
Absolutely. I think if it's not something that you've personally experienced, then I think you do need to do a little bit of that research to make sure it is a very authentic storytelling. And so for me, I talked to friends. I've done lots of research and reading people's articles that they write about for a lot of the outlets that, you know, I used to write for, and those sorts of stories that really touch women's lives. And just, again, trying to just make it as real and true that people could relate to. And so with Best Years of Your Life, I could relate to the academia side point, but then I talked to a lot of people from the LGBTQ community because there was those characters, which I'm not part of that community myself. So same thing. I think in all of my books, I start with something I know. So for this one, it's like motherhood. I can speak to it. I can, you know, even though I don't have that infertility component, I think that, you know, that's something that I could do my research and bring that in. And it pairs well with the things that I do know and that I can speak to.
That's great. I always am encouraging field research as well. Maybe it's just because personally, I find that the most interesting form of research mm-hmm. when you can talk to people and really understand their experiences. As you were writing this story, were there any areas that you felt really drawn to emotionally, really connected to emotionally, that you walked away that day and you thought to yourself, yes, this is exactly how I hoped this day would go? Or are there any days that you were struggling, any pieces of the story that you felt more difficult to write? And how did you work through those struggles if you did experience that?
I think definitely there's highs and lows as a writer. There are some days where you are like spot on and you're like, oh my gosh, this is just, it's flowing. Like the words are just coming out of me like a faucet and can't stop. And you hit your word goals and it's great. And then there's other days where you're just sort of struggling and nothing comes to you or doesn't sound right or anything like that. So I try to just be really gracious and, you know, to myself and not put too much pressure to make everything perfect, especially with the first draft. I just want to get my ideas out. And then, you know, that's where the revision process comes in. But I think in this story, I felt really good about writing Kate's character. She is the main protagonist, the woman in question of what to do when this baby shows up, because I could really feel her longing and desperation. The other primary protagonist, her name's Jada, and without giving too much away, she has her own personal struggles. And again, I had to do a lot of research for that. So some of those storylines were a little bit more tough for me because, again, it wasn't something that I personally dealt with, but that I just wanted to make them, you know, as authentic as possible. So I just took my time with them, lots of revisions and having other outside eyes to read it and give feedback and rework sections that needed rework.
That's great. Now, you mentioned that you're working with a publisher. So you would have had an editor who was assigned to you, I'm assuming,
yes,
in this situation, where in the past you've hired your own developmental editor and your own copy editors in order to get the book ready for publication. How was that experience? Did it feel similar, different? What did you like about it, not like about it?
Like you said, working with the publisher, you're assigned an editor, and I was put with someone who is great. I loved her. We hit it off and she was wonderful. When I was self-publishing, I had to hire outside freelancers. And so I did sort of like almost like a little interview process. And I had maybe three that I was debating between, and we would hop on like a quick Zoom just to kind of like feel it out, because I do think personality and just you get a vibe from people and all that kind of stuff. So I ended up choosing someone for my last self-published book, whereas this time I didn't really have a choice. It was, you know, here's your editor. And what if you didn't really like mesh? What if, you know, just, I don't know, styles and personality and all that. But I was lucky that everything worked out really well. And she actually went on maternity leave right at the end. Since I'm working on the second book with them, they ended up moving me to someone new. So I've kind of had a double experience, and it's been interesting to work with two different editors at Book Couture and see different styles. But all in all, it's been a really good experience.
Do you feel like when they give you feedback, is it similar in style to how feedback is delivered, or has the style been different?
So in my experience, I have received sort of like an editorial letter. I would say maybe a page to three page sort of letter with the big high view feedback points, this, that, and the other, and then inline sort of edits throughout the document, mm-hmm. not as detailed as like a line edit,
right?
At the first pass, the developmental stage. And then there's a lot more editing. So we go line editing and proofreading and copy editing, all of it. So the editing process for me was probably 6 weeks or so long. Pass it back and forth between you and the editor several times.
And they do all of it, right? That so you have one editor who do developmental line editing and copy editing, or do they have different editors?
No. So the editor did the developmental and the line editing, I believe. And then they had a separate copy editor and I think a separate proofreader. So it's multiple sets of eyes, which I think is really good. And I am here to tell you, I cannot believe the amount of stuff, the little typos that slipped through the cracks. But I have read my own manuscript dozens of times. Then it goes to the editor several times. And each person that gets it keeps finding these little things. I remember writing back to the editor just saying, like, I just want to like bow down to you. I cannot believe these little things that are getting cut, which is good because ultimately that means it's a cleaner book that goes out into the world. It's just wild.
I know. So my aunt was a writer and she was kind of a savant with grammar. It'd be one of those things where I've always said to everyone, I'm a developmental editor. I am not a copy editor in any way because you'd really have to be zeroed in on word by word. And I think like as to spending time reading, spending time working with writers, you naturally become more skilled at copy editing, but it is just a different set of eyes. Sometimes that's just what it is. It's just passing it to a different set of eyes. My aunt would sometimes reach out to me if I had, you know, misspelled thing or something, and she'd always be so kind about it. It's like, I don't want to overstep, but I'd be like, please bring it on. Because I want those copy editing comments because they can be very, there's little subtle changes that I hear you on that. It's amazing.
I was just like, oh my gosh, thank you so much for catching all of this. You know, I just can't believe that, you know, after so many sets of passes that there was still little things there.
Yeah. Well, it's great. I mean, like you said, it means that there's a more polished book out in the world, which is great. You mentioned earlier that this has a suspense feel. So upmarket suspense novel, we'd probably call this, right? Not for a category and genre. And I get that with the cover. And that, you know, I know that this is a podcast, so we're not seeing it, but I'll describe it and I'll obviously link to the book for people to go buy it. And it's the Baby Left Behind. So that alone, the title feels more thrilling, more suspense, right? And on the cover, we have more, I'd say like darker tones, right? So we have dark blues and shadier gray blacks that are kind of bringing a shade to the blues. We have a crib and we have a nice vibrant pink blanket on the crib and we have a light shining in on the crib that is empty. So it does feel more suspenseful to look at that crib, an empty crib, with the darker hues coming in and then the illuminated crib itself. So I feel that suspense. So I feel like this is an opportunity for definitely a book club type of book as well. It feels like there could be a lot of discussion around this topic, but it's blending with the suspense. And, you know, that's a great combo. So just curious if that's where you always wanted to go with genres. Or is this story just kind of what pulled you in that direction?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. This is exactly how I describe my books, which is sort of domestic suspense novel. Suspense not in the sense of, you know, a killer coming after you or, you know, a psychological thriller, but really just like relationships and emotional drama. And it's centered usually in female protagonists. That's where I tend to sort of live. Interestingly, when I pitched this to the couture and they loved it right away, got back to me, but we sort of went back and forth a little bit and they almost wanted to package it as a psychological thriller. And that was going to require me to do some pretty substantial revisions to make it even darker. And, you know, that creepy element that this psychological thriller sort of had. And, you know, it's easy as a writer to just jump on any sort of opportunity that comes your way and like, okay, fine, I'll do whatever you say because you just want that deal or you want that agent or whatever. And it just wasn't sitting right with me again. And I talked to, you know, some of my writer friends and I'm just like, I don't know. I don't see myself as a psychological thriller writer. I don't see this book as that. And so I stuck to my guns, kind of went back and just respectfully said, you know what, like, I would love to have a compromise. I'd love to kind of find a middle ground here because I really see it as this. And they were fine with it. They were like, okay, yeah, no problem. Like, we'll keep it sort of as that emotional suspense, women's fiction suspense sort of thing. And so it worked out really well.
I love that you stuck to your guns. This is something I talk about with writers all the time, is when to take feedback, even just something when you get the feedback, often, especially from a marketing perspective, there will be discussion about this could go this way, but that doesn't mean that it's the only way that it can go. So I love that you knew what your story was, and it speaks, you know, it's a testament that you were the right writer for this story, because it came to life through your vision of it. Even when I look at it, the best example I can think of is the adoption story in Little Fires Everywhere. That's how it feels to me. It's that type of suspense. It's like we're dealing with a lot bigger discussions than just creepy,
right?
You know, psychological, exactly like what you said. But at the same time, we feel nervous for the character because we know that she has put herself in this very dangerous situation because of the decision that she makes in order to keep the baby.
Yeah, I think and also another distinction too is that my stories tend to be less crime or, you know, death sort of related and more like ethical, like a moral dilemma sort of situation, which I love. Like none of them are usually life or death. It's more of just like your conscience making these choices and then the ramifications.
Okay, love that. And then with that, without giving away too many details in the book, how do you structure a story like that successfully for the target readers? Like if you're saying, you know, we could go psychological suspense, you said, no, I see it more in this women's fiction suspense area with the ethical dilemmas, with the emotional pull, the emotional story is driving it. Is there a strategy that you have on what you are prioritizing for characters and structure and plot as you design the book?
I try to get to the hook pretty quickly just because, again, I think just in general, regardless of genre or anything, readers' attention spans are just really shorter than ever. And so you got to kind of get to the point. And so the dilemma happens pretty close to the beginning here. And so you're pulled in immediately. And then just drawing it out. It's just like one thing after the next where the reader's like cringing, like, oh my gosh, like what's going to happen? How could she do this? Or what, you know, what would I do in this situation? And I try to sprinkle in, you know, instant could flip and could make the right decision and do what's right, but they don't, because again, that's human nature and you're already so far in, you're trapped, you got to keep going sort of thing. So just kind of pulling the reader along, upping the stakes, upping the tension. But then I always like there to be some sort of, once you hit the climax and then there's like a fallout of some sort, we have to deal with that too, because you can't just drop it off then. The reader wants to know, like, well, what happens and what are the consequences of these actions? And is there any sort of redemption that happens?
So do you find that you, and I know that you have these amazing boards with all your post-it notes.
Yes.
I've seen that. When you are starting out your story, do you think that you start with key plot points then that would get this to the point of the book very quickly? And then on a scene level, do you write linear? Do you just go and see how it develops, or do you jump around?
I am a plotter 100%. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I have like my little colored post-it notes that I map out the story. I usually start with just like a Word doc and just like bullet points. Once I have like that fleshed out a little bit, then I'll kind of go to my plotting board, but I'm definitely a linear writer. I always think it's interesting when I see other writers who they're like, oh, I just wrote a chapter down the road, or I just wrote the ending. I'm like, what? I can't even wrap my head around that. Like my brain is very linear. So I usually write the first draft and it ends up being short, like in terms of word length or word count. You know, I might end up with between 50 and 60,000 words and my target is usually around 80,000. So that first draft, I know it's not long enough. I know it's not detailed enough or fleshed out. And so then I kind of go back through and really expand and deepen. But that first one is just kind of hitting all those, the main plot points.
How do you know when you're onto something? Do you start to get more and more excited on the scene level as you're going forward? What's that sense of, all right, I've got the story. This is working now. This is what I understand is going to bring me to the climax that I want to reach.
Yes, definitely. I usually start out with just like a singular scene in my head. So for this one, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's pretty obvious that this is going to happen, is that like she opens the door and there's a baby on her doorstep, you know? So that's a very powerful scene. And then figuring out what could be the other scene. Like in my head, I picture it almost as like a movie. If I was watching the movie, what would happen? Like, what would the facial expressions be like? What if her parents came over? Then what? And just like hiding behind the curtain, wondering who's watching, that kind of stuff. So I usually can see like the big pivotal scene and then just imagine the rest.
That's awesome. Super fun. I love that you're following, again, your intuition. And something else that you just mentioned a little bit ago is about pitching to Tor. So BookTor is your publisher. Was BookTor the publisher that you always wanted to work with? Were you querying multiple publishers? And I guess back step a little bit, because I'm getting ahead of myself. What made you decide that The Baby Left Behind, you wanted to pursue a publisher where Best Years of Our Lives, you decided self-publishing?
Yes. I really loved self-publishing. So I was happy with it. I thought that that would probably be where maybe I stayed, you know, for a while. But I always wanted to be open and flexible to all different things and all different opportunities. And really what made my decision to even pursue or consider any sort of publisher was just working with the publisher can get your name out there more, can get your book out there more. And so it was solely from the idea of growing my audience, growing my brand. I just wanted to maybe give it a shot and see what it was like and not say like, okay, this is my future. That's like really important to me, is just saying like, I can jump around. I can switch. I can go back and forth. Like, yes, if you sign a contract with someone, you're in that contract. But if that contract ends, you know, you can go do whatever you'd like. So I did not want to jump back in the query trenches because I just find it so awful and it was so difficult. So I was thinking of small presses that I could pitch that take unagented submissions. And Book Couture was one. I had one writing friend who is with them and she always had great things to say. And so really, I threw out probably, I don't know, maybe six or so pitches to some small presses. Heard back from two or three, had sort of like a call with maybe two, and Book Couture was by and far the best response that I got, the best feel for their vision of the book and just kind of like what they do. But it's been a very different experience for sure, like going from self-publishing to working with the publisher. And there's definitely pros and cons.
And just for listeners to clarify, so Book Couture is spelled BookOuture, because I know that it can.
So it's like, Book Couture.
Exactly. Yeah. And I'll put that in the show notes as well, if it's a publisher that other people would be interested in pursuing.
Yes. They are a division of Hachette and out of the UK. So a digital publisher.
And so with something like this, with being a division of Hachette, so that's one of the major publishers. And sometimes they'd say, okay, you need to have a literary agent in order to pursue publishing, so it's not unsolicited. So how is this different? Because you did not go into the query trenches. You did this individually. Did you just know, is that part of the submission guidelines that they take unsolicited material? I know you had a friend, so you knew a little bit more about this personally.
I was strictly looking for places to submit unagented because it just wasn't something I was interested in at the time, was to look for the agent. And so, right on Book Couture's website, they have a little button that says submit your manuscript, and it's, you know, you can submit. And I think they say to give them maybe a month, which is a fairly quick turnaround, really, if you think about it. But I heard back definitely within 2 weeks, maybe even less time. So I think like if they find something they like, they're pretty quick to respond, which was really great. And so,
Yeah, that feels like a super fast turnaround.
I was surprised.
Yes, I was going to say it. They liked your story.
Yes.
Yeah, which is very encouraging. When you are pitching to them, so this is something else that I wanted to dig into, because pitching a book can be really hard. Writing a story is so different than writing sales copy and sales pitch. How do you go about constructing your pitches? And did you feel like when you were pitching to Book Couture that the structure of that pitch, what you paid attention to that pitch, was similar or different to when you were writing back cover for Amazon or anything that you were pursuing with self-publishing? Mm-hmm.
What I pitched to them was pretty much a query letter, essentially. So, you know, if anyone is out there and is either in the query trenches or knows about that, like you write this query letter and it kind of has a pretty set sort of formula to follow, explaining the book, explaining where you think it would sit, your comps, like that kind of stuff. So short and sweet. And so that's kind of what I sensed. And it wasn't too salesy in terms of like the back cover copy. I sort of saved that because I also know if you're working with a publisher, they're probably going to write that for you. A lot of the things that a self-published author does on their own is out of your hands once you're with a publisher. So I just tried to like pitch it the best that I could, like really emphasizing that hook. Plus the whole thing was written. So I sent along the manuscript and, you know, the rest was history.
Speaking of hooks, I think this is another area where writers, they put a lot of pressure on themselves because hooks are crucial. Hooks sell a book. So you have to have a hook in order for your story to work. But what do you think can determine a good hook for a story? Like if writers are debating about whether or not they have something that's hooky enough for their book, have you ever in your brainstorming sessions been to a place or even starting with this book, did your hook start with what it was or did it start somewhere else? And then you built on that in order to probably the best hook for your story?
For me, I think the hook is, it's the plot, but then it's the emotion. So yes, this book is a baby shows up on your doorstep. Like that's a pretty strong hook, but then it's that dilemma and that moral question of like, what do I do? And it forces the reader to think to themselves, like, what would I do in that situation? And I think regardless if it's a baby on your doorstep or any sort of other situation like that, where you have to make a quick decision, I think readers can picture themselves in the character's, you know, position and sort of it draws you into the story and you want to know like, okay, I know what I would do, but what does this character do? So for me, those are sort of always like my hooks. But I think having something like that is a great way to get readers' attention or the agent or whoever you're trying to attract with the book. And also some sort of like a clever teaser line that you can put on either the front cover or the back cover that really it's like that question. It's that rhetorical question. Like on mine, it says, he's all you've ever wanted, but can keep him. And so you're like, ooh, you know, like, oh my gosh, what's happening here? And it's that ethical line that the protagonist is going to cross.
Then again, you're going back to your ethical dilemmas here, which is yes. What your main goal is. And yes, I'm glad that you read that because that's exactly what happens. I see that catchphrase for your book, and that immediately is calling to question the reader. It's pulling the reader into the story so that they can, you know, be living through the characters and making that debate themselves, which is great.
I've seen some agents say that they don't love rhetorical questions in query letters. They're a little iffy whether to include them or not. I personally love rhetorical questions because I think they're really engaging the reader. So maybe to the reader is maybe different than to the agent, perhaps, because the agent wants to just like, tell me what this story is about. You know, they don't have a lot of time. They don't want to be like beating around the bush. But I think for cover copy, a rhetorical question can be really effective.
I agree with that. So I discourage writers from having rhetorical questions and queries. And I think the reason for that is because when rhetorical questions are included in queries, I've seen more on average, the writers depend on that rhetorical question and don't really pitch the story. Right. So they're not pitching the plot. They're leaning more on that rhetorical question at the end, which to writers, I think can feel very confusing because if you go on Amazon, you see rhetorical questions all the time. But at that point, it's already that back cover has already been so fine-tuned that you really can see the plot. Or if you look up something like not your genre, but Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets is one that I've done a lot of work with. And on Amazon, it doesn't even really pitch the story, but it's Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets. Like, it's already done its job selling.
Exactly.
So it doesn't need to do that. And you're trying to sell the book to the agent. So if you're leaning more and depending more on the rhetorical question, but not pitching the plot, the agent doesn't know what they're picking up. You know, what they're selling for a back cover instead. And yours does a really good job of this on Bookator and, you know, on your website as well. It's starting off with more the status quo of the character, who they are, what they are, their status. And then we want to see that hook, right? What throws them off? What throws their situation off in that second paragraph? And then what are they going to do about it? So if you can pitch it more in the plot that way, that is going to tell the story in a way that the rhetorical question should already almost be answering. So I think that's the thing. Maybe sometimes writers, if they like rhetorical questions, start with a rhetorical question for themselves, but then see if they can answer that through context in the pitch.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
So let's talk more about now your decision to go with Bookator instead of self-publishing, because I just think that you're so smart, and I love that how you always weigh all your decisions, and I love your flexibility in evaluating what is best for your book or story. I think that's something that you do really well. And I know that you mentioned this in the other interview. You've never said it's only self-publishing is the best way to go, or traditional publishing is the only way to go. Like, that's never been you. You've always been, I really enjoyed this about self-publishing. I really like this about traditional publishing, but I need to weigh the odds for what is best on a book-by-book basis, unless you're in a contract, right? Sure. And then you know that you're going some way. So I think that that is really insightful of you. And I love that you reflect and have such confidence in the direction that you pursue. A ways back, I'd have to look back how many months now because I've been on leave, but a ways back, you had an Instagram post, and I'll try to include this in the show notes as well, about how you've had a different experience now, just weighing the odds of what are some things that go differently between self-publishing and publishing with a traditional publisher. I would love to hear your experience there. What have you really enjoyed? What are some things that you wish you maybe were able to still do, or some things that you didn't like as much with self-publishing? I know it's probably an open-ended question.
Yes.
But you, I'm going to let you take the lead on this because I know that you've reflected on this because of this Instagram post. And immediately when I saw that, I was like, oh, I'm going to have Jen back.
Yeah, it's, I loved that post. And I did get a lot of feedback and, you know, comments from people because they were like, this was so insightful and I didn't think of that, or, you know, whatever. But in my experience, this is my first rodeo with working with a publisher. And yeah, there's definitely advantages. And then there's things that I do miss. So on one hand, having a team behind me, like this professional, very skilled publishing team to do all of the technical stuff has been wonderful. So I didn't have to do any, you know, formatting on my own, or yes, I reviewed edits, but I wasn't having to hire editors on my own, anything like that. They did all the conversions, they're doing all the uploading. So all of that like back end techie sort of stuff, which again, I had to learn the first time around, and you know, I could do it again, certainly, but it's off my plate and it's one less thing to do. And so that's kind of nice. That's been great. I do miss having a lot of the creative control that I had as an independent author, because when it was just me, I could make all the decisions. I designed my own covers. I named my book what I wanted to name it. I wrote back cover copy. I reached out for blurbs. Everything, like the book packaging, was exactly how I envisioned it, how I wanted it to be. And this time around, I had no control over any of that. And that was a really big pill for me to swallow. It was probably the most difficult thing that I encountered with this experience of being with a publisher. And so it did force me to really step back and sort of talk to myself internally, just saying like, listen, it's okay to not have control over everything. And it's okay to put your trust in these people. They know what they're doing. The Book Couture has a really great track record with their sales, with their marketing. And they are very data driven. So they've done all this research to know what type of titles sell for their demographics, for their readership, what the covers look like, what to include there, how to package it. And again, it may not have been exactly what I would have done if I did it on my own. And it may not have been what I had originally envisioned for this book after spending a year writing it. But at the end of the day, part of me signing that contract was allowing this to happen and right, trusting them that they are going to do it well. And now, after that initial sort of discomfort, maybe, if that's even the right word, mm-hmm, has sort of lessened and I've come around to the end. I'm totally happy with the book. I love everything about it. I think they've done an amazing job and it is exactly what it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. But just being type A and a perfectionist and a control freak, admittedly, that was hard. And so right, that was one of the big things that I do still sometimes miss. And I'm sure there will be another book down the road that I do self-publish and I'll enjoy those things again. But for now, I'm just trying to remind myself of weighing it all. Like, yes, I had to give up some of this, but look at all this other stuff that I'm getting, lots of advantages of being with the publisher.
I think discomfort is a pretty justified word, because if you are used to the control, you know, writing in general is a vulnerable place to be. Right. Mm-hmm. So you are giving your story more into the hands of others, and not just one person, but multiple people who are, yes, having a lot of feedback. Like you even said, just the rounds of editing and the details, mm-hmm, of editing, that alone is like multiple people. And it can lead to a more, you know, maybe even just grammatically better published. But
right,
at the same time, that's a lot of eyes, a lot of opinions on one story. there's advantages and disadvantages to that. And I think it's just whatever your comfortability is, be getting over that. And now do you feel good? Like you feel like this is definitely the right choice for Baby Left Behind. But would you say that that's true?
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah. I'm very happy with like where this book has landed, what it looks like, who, how it's packaged, who it's for. I think, you know, they were spot on. That just was me adjusting my expectations a little bit and, you know, just being a lot more flexible. And one of the other things that I wanted to get across when I wrote that original blog post that you mentioned when I discussed all of this was I didn't want to come off like whiny by saying all of this. I didn't want people to say like, okay, like she's fairly pretty ungrateful. You know, here she is, like got this publishing deal and there's lots of authors who would love to have that or whatever. That wasn't my intention. My intention was just to be really honest about the experience of going from one to the other. And because I think sometimes, you know, in our social media world and where you see all the good stuff, but you don't necessarily hear or see all of the, kind of the struggles and the challenges that come with publishing. And so this was, yeah, a small thing in the grand scheme of life, but something that like was part of the process.
No, I think the honesty is really important because when writers are trying to make their decision on what way to go, it's better for them to have that information up front. That's part of my goal with LitMatch is to break the transparency, you know?
Yes.
So it's helping give more information. So I hear literary agents say it all the time that they want writers to really know what way they want to go too, because you might, self-publishing might be the better route for you. Traditional publishing might be the better route for you. It's better to have knowledge so that you can
absolutely
make it for you and have a good experience.
Yeah.
The Baby Left Behind. So you mentioned title. Was that not the original title?
Not the original title. No.
Ask me about title because I think naming books is one of the more challenging tasks.
Very.
Usually I can hear a title and I'm like, yes, I love that title. But when it comes to me actually figuring out the title, not necessarily my strength. So I'd love to hear your experience with titles because that can be something that everyone has to think about as a writer.
Movement.
Probably also an area that all of us struggle with at some point.
Yeah. So when I am trying to title my books, I agree it's so hard. And sometimes I have the title or an idea for a title way early in the process. And other times I'm like, the book is written. And I still don't know what the heck to call it. You know, I always try to make it tie into the story, or it could even be a line from the story, like something someone says. So for this one, the original title for The Baby Left Behind that I had titled it when I pitched it was called Small Desperate Things. And it was kind of a play full of like Big Little Lies, because it kind of had that vibe of like the three short words in like that punchy little title. So Small Desperate Things. And it came from a line that one of the characters says in the book, which again, the line is still in the book. So readers will still see that. And that's where I had originally come up with the title. But when I pitched it, they kind of came back and we had already signed the contract and everything. And, you know, it wasn't going to be a deal breaker for me if I couldn't title. But they did kind of gently sort of, you know, crush my bubble a little bit, saying like, yeah, that's not going to be the title. And so I was like, okay. But what they came up with, it fits very much into their, you know, portfolio of books, which are lean a little bit more commercial. So it's a very commercial title and the cover's commercial. And yeah, the story itself, it could be considered commercial fiction as well. I think that I'm a little bit upmarket-ish, but I'm also fine with commercial fiction. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think Book Couture kind of is more of a commercial publisher. And so they package their books in that way. And so their titles tend to be a little bit more literal, you know, like there's actually a baby and the baby is left behind, you know, and it matches the cover with the empty crib. So if you're going for more of like that, a literary feel with a literary type cover, which I, as a reader, am really drawn to, like the beautiful artistic covers, that's definitely not what mine is, but I'm okay with that because I think it matches and it fits the book.
You answered my question before I asked it. I was going to say, what can you define what you think the difference is between a commercial, more commercial title versus an upmarket title? And it sounds like more literal.
Yes.
Is commercial. So commercial, we're getting right to the point. This is the mass audience that we're reaching. And with that market, more room for discussion, maybe more of a literary feel, but not quite literary, right?
Yes.
And, you know, I always say upmarket is the baby of commercial and literary. I probably categorize yours as that market as well, but a market can often be categorized as, you know, commercial, depending on whose eyes are on it. So the other thing that I found so really interesting is you said that this is, you know, Book Tour is a branch of or an imprint of Hachette. Is it an imprint?
Yes, or division. Is that one?
Okay, so yeah, I want to make sure I say the word right. So Book Tour is a division of Hachette, and it's a UK division. Yes. So that's really interesting because you pursued a UK division versus an American division, but you are in America.
Right.
So what was your decision with that? And did you think that that played into taste at all for the audience?
I knew that they were based in the UK. I knew they were like a UK publisher, but I also knew that they had reach into the States. And my friend who publishes with them also lives in the States. She's American too. So, and when they were talking, when we had our initial calls and stuff, they made it very clear that, you know, they market and sell all over the place. And I wouldn't say maybe that their author breakdown is 50-50 British and American, but they have plenty of American writers. So I didn't feel like out of place or that it wasn't a good fit. It's been interesting working with, you know, British team, and just from the communication standpoint of like time zones, and like our meetings are usually in the morning for me and it's the afternoon for them, and just making sure like that all sort of fits. But taste wise, no, I think they know their audience, and it doesn't really matter, you know, the country that the reader's coming from. I think like they try to pick universal stories that really hit on like that human emotion. So it's universal.
Well, and that makes sense for being a more commercially driven publisher as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So with this, right now, is it just in UK and the States, or does it hope to branch out into international locations?
Yeah, Book Couture has a really great rights team. And so they try and secure rights for all their titles in different markets, and it'll be out in audiobook as well. And then they have like film options that they try to pursue. Like they really do make every effort to make all their titles as successful as possible and in lots of different routes. So I know like they had their big runaway hit in this past year or so, the Housemaid, the Freda McFadden. That book was everywhere. It was all over the place. And coming from a digital publisher, they don't promise any sort of print runs that are going to be in bookstores, but that one was so successful that it's in airports and it's in bookstores. I think they're making a, I don't know if it's a Netflix series or I think it's been optioned for film and all sorts of stuff. So that's always really encouraging to see the publisher that you're with having this great success with another title. Like I'm cheering her on, and that's amazing because I think other people's success is only helping my success,
which is awesome. The other thing that I was thinking about, the difference between self-publishing and traditional publishing, and this is a misunderstanding a lot for writers when they're pursuing traditional publishing. They think that if I go traditional publishing, the marketing will be taken care of for me. And of course, no matter if you're self-published or traditional published, you have a lot of hand in the marketing because you're responsible for a lot of the marketing of the story. So I first wanted to know, how is the marketing for The Baby Left Behind going for you? And did you feel if there's a little bit less weight that you had to carry for that? I know as a self-published author, that is one of the things you have to consider is that you're in charge of everything.
Yep.
So it is nice probably to say, okay, I can hand some of the stuff up. But marketing, is that one of them? Or what are you responsible for in marketing for the book? And has it felt different than what you've had to do for Best Years of Our Lives?
I was assigned a marketing person from the publisher, and they've been great. There's been actually like probably two. One was more like geared towards Hub Day, like the actual launch, and one was a little bit more just like general sort of publicity and marketing and that sort of stuff. Like they've created amazing graphics, way better photography than I could do on my own, you know, great lighting, studio lighting, all that kind of stuff. So beautiful graphics that they can then they've shared with me that I can then post and all that kind of stuff. So that's been really nice. But like you said, the author still should and probably needs to do a lot on their own as well, which I don't have a problem with that. Like I try to get fun and creative with the marketing. So I don't mind doing a lot of that on my own. But it is nice having the publisher behind me because they've been able to reach out to a lot more media outlets and that kind of stuff. And I do think just coming like a pitch or a press release from a publisher, it might come with a little more clout, perhaps, than just some, you know, no-name self-published author, and I'm not trying to like downgrade myself because, you know, I believe in myself, but to the average bookstore out there, to the average, you know, online publication or magazine or whatever, they're kind of like, who is this chick? Like, you know, no. But to a publisher, they may open that email or they may consider or something like that. So that's been nice. Again, it's not always an automatic yes.
Right.
But it's something. So it's been a balance, I would say. And the marketing's been fun. I feel like I put a little less pressure on myself this time around for various reasons, not just because I have a publisher behind me, but just, I don't know. I just feel like I did so much for my last release for Best Years of Your Life that it was a lot. And I felt a little burned out after, you know, a couple months. And yeah. So I kind of just wanted to sit back and be a little bit less demanding on myself this time.
I think that you deserve that.
Yeah,
that's great.
Very insightful. We are at the top of the hour. So I'm thinking mm-hmm. about what my previous at the end of every podcast, I usually do a lightning three. And I had an idea for some lightning three, but what you've been saying here is helping me revise my lightning three questions a little bit. So if you're good, we'll probably move into that. We're going to focus on this area here. My first question, I guess, is, and this calls to mind another one of your great reels that you do on Instagram. And it was one with self-publishing and all of the roles that you were responsible for. So picking back off what you've had to do for marketing, self-publishing versus traditional publishing, if you were to look at your two experiences now, what do you think are some of the major roles that you've had to do as a self-publisher and as someone who is now being published with a division, a Hachette, what are some of those roles that you've been able to say, I don't need to focus on as much, but here are the roles that I really do need to focus on? So as a writer, what have you really had to spend your time, what have you really had to concentrate your time on and focus your time on in order to get this book out into the world? Versus when you were self-published, you had to be thinking about book launch on top of everything else, on top of the writing, the edits, the design, all of that. Mm-hmm. So that was a very wordy way to question it.
Yeah. So I would say that this time being with the publisher, I've enjoyed not having to do a lot of that technical stuff that I mentioned before, like the formatting. Right. Converting files and sending out all the arcs and, you know, making sure all of that kind of stuff. So that's all been handled on their end, which has been really great. And it allows me to be just more of like the creative, which is, I think, what a lot of writers have in their head of like, I want to be a writer. I just want to write. Like, can't someone else do all that other stuff for me? And it's true. Like, you can hire people to do the editing, the formatting, all of those sorts of things. But if that's not in your budget and you want to self-publish, then it's something you have to learn if you want to do it yourself. I'm glad to have not had to do that this time around. That was nice. And not worrying about like margins and this is not print and write and this is the indents and just all of the wonky stuff that goes into manuscript formatting.
Well, long question to that. Does that make you feel like you have more freedom or room to spend with your imagination on the story itself because you don't have to be worrying about all the margins, or is that all more just aftermath?
That was a little aftermath for mm-hmm. me. Like, if my document was a mess, it was just something that I knew I was going to have to spend some time fixing later.
Sure.
But now, and I, of course, I don't want to send my publisher this like crazy manuscript, but I'm not worried about it because they have someone on their end. They're way more tech savvy than me who probably could solve it in a snap, whereas I had to Google a million things to learn to figure out how to do it on my own.
Sure. Okay. So for the second question, you mentioned that you had a 2-book deal when you signed BookTour. Now, when you pitched The Baby Left Behind previously, what did you call it?
Small Desperate Things.
Yeah. Previously Small Desperate Things. So when you pitched that, did you know what your next book was going to be? And see, my third question is going to, of course, be what's next? So you can move into that if you want to after this. But when you were pitching this, did you need to know that story ahead of time? Or was that something that you bounced ideas back and forth with them afterwards? Did you like that support if that was the case? How did you do that bouncing back and forth if that's where it went?
Yeah, that's a great question. Because when I pitched The Baby Left Behind, it was done. It was completely written. If I wouldn't have gotten any sort of bites on it from any publishers, I would have self-published it again completely as it was. Once we agreed to a contract and figured out the path for it, It underwent a pretty big revision. Like I would say this whole second half of the book got kind of rewritten because of various factors and what they preferred that I did and how it turned out. So that took a lot of time. With book two, I had that first big plot point, kind of the hook in my head, but that was it. I didn't have anything written, but I wanted to really make sure that I kind of got it like approved, quote unquote, by the editor before I started writing, because for me, it was sort of like, I don't want to waste my time writing a book that you're going to then tear apart and be like, make me rewrite it. So like, what's the point? Right. So I outlined it all, pretty detailed outline, and then sent it to her and said, what do you think? I'm thinking this for the second book. And then we went from there and kind of had it all mapped out before I started writing. So I didn't have to have any of that like major, major revisions. Of course, there's always revisions during it, but
right.
Nothing major. And so, yeah, that was kind of how that went. I loved having that feedback because, again, I'm all about efficiency and I don't want to be spending time and creative energy writing something that I'm feeling really passionate about and I'm enjoying. It's the editor's going to not like it, like, right. You know, so I was happy to have her input. And it was kind of like a little bit of a partnership, I guess, to kind of flesh out the story and then jump on the writing.
Well, to piggyback off of this, or it has a follow-up question, I guess. Traditional publishing, I think one of the reasons why people don't want to pursue it is because it can be a slower process.
Yeah.
Instead of publishing, you can publish tomorrow if you wanted to. Now, I feel like your books are on a faster schedule.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So, because my understanding is that on average, from once it goes to market and it sells to an editor, the average is about 18 months before the title comes out. And that's for one book. And then, a whole nother, I guess you would probably pick your deadline, but what is that? What are we needing? What's that schedule look like? And yours have to come out within a year, it feels like. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So my last self-published, Best Years of Your Life, came out August 22. Mm-hmm. And so The Baby Left Behind is coming out September 23. So just over a year later. But when I signed the two-book deal, they said, like, I don't think they refer to it as like rapid release, like some self-publishers, they put out a book every 2 months or something, 2 or 3 months. This is a little bit more like twice a year, two books a year is kind of like their goal. That's kind of their sweet spot is what I'm understanding. And the reason behind it is that their readership, like if they like a book and like an author, they're hungry for the next. And so Bookjour really wants to have that ready. So by the time this book comes out, September 2023, the second book that I signed with them is already complete. It's already, it's in editing mode, but it's written. It's fully written.
You moved fast. You were.
Yes. But that was something that when I signed, I knew I had to. And they weren't like, really hard. If I would have said, oh, could we push it a month? I'm sure it would have been fine. But I agreed to it because it's kind of their style and I wanted to go with it. I wanted to experience it and kind of push myself and test myself a little bit, give myself a little challenge. I don't know that I will be like a two book a year author for the rest of my life because it was a lot.
Fire in your fingers for sure.
Yes, I like one book a year. And so we'll see. I don't know going forward if they will offer me any sort of like contract extension or want to keep working with me or if I'll be going back to self-publishing. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm just trying to stay open to it and put out books that I'm proud of and that I love.
It's a good priority. Also, I love that you are feeling like you can communicate with them. And that feels really important that if you do go with a publisher, that you do feel like there is, even if there are areas that they're going to just have more control over, can you still have conversations?
Right.
That feels important. Third question, important question, what is next? So I know that you know the story if it's already in revisions.
Yep.
So tell us, when is this next story coming out from you?
Well, it has no title because, again, the publisher will choose that for me, but we haven't solidified anything and I haven't heard anything from them yet on it. But I can tell you that it does follow right in line with my sort of niche of these stories revolving around these female protagonists making questionable decisions and secrets and consequences and that sort of stuff. So in a nutshell, we've got two best friends in their 40s. And one has a teenage daughter who ends up with a secret. And instead of confiding in her mother, she confides in the best friend of the mother. And so then the best friend mother has this dilemma of, do I tell my friend her daughter's secret or do I not? that's the general premise. But then there's, of course, like subplot lines and a lot of suspense and drama along the way.
Very easy to imagine that happening, that situation happening. I'm super curious what that secret is, but I'm sure you have to keep that a secret from us for now. But yeah, that sounds great. Another one that I would be definitely adding to my reading list.
Thank you.
Yes. And, you know, Jen, thank you so much for being here. Once again, you've been so insightful. I wish it all the best. I'm excited to encourage everyone to go read it. And you can do so in the show notes. Where else can we find you, Jen, if listeners want to find you?
I hang out mostly on Instagram. That's my favorite platform. So you can find me at Jen Craven Author. And my website is jencraven.com. So all the buy links are there. I love supporting bookshop.org, which helps indie bookstores. But you can find my books lots of different places.
All right. Thank you so much, Jen. It was such a pleasure to have you here. And I'm so excited to see where you go next. Thank you so much for coming back for this episode of Lit Match. The last several months have been a particularly busy time for me, and I haven't been able to release episodes as consistently as I hoped. I am eager to do so, and I am both humbled and honored to bring you conversations about writing and publishing whenever and as soon as I can. I genuinely appreciate each listener's support and enthusiasm for the podcast. I am incredibly grateful to anyone who has reached out to give me feedback on ways to improve the podcast, or a quick email about what this podcast means to them. I understand how intimidating and overwhelming writing and the publishing industry can be. I'm sincerely thrilled to support writers, editors, literary agents, and publishing professionals by sharing each episode's advice and conversations with my amazing guests. I'm very lucky to have spoken to each person who has come on the show. I continue to be grateful for all those who come on the show and all you listeners who support it. If you're looking for more ways to support Lit Match and you have a quick 2 minutes, I would so appreciate if you rated and reviewed the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast server. This signals that Lit Match is a podcast that matters and helps me reach more kindred creatives like you who want to learn more about writing novels and publishing them. A million thank yous to everyone who has written a review and all those who take the time in the future. That's all I have for today. Until next time, happy writing. And if you're in the query trenches, I'm cheering you on. I know how grueling this place can be, but I also believe that despite how competitive publishing is, new books do come out every Tuesday. And the world needs more books. We need more stories from resilient writers like you. I'm looking forward to hearing when you sign with the best literary agent and business partner for your publishing career and celebrate your book when it comes out.